Said our text this evening is Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So you enroll on a theology course and you're having an initial meeting with your tutor, during which the tutor at one point drops in a sentence like this. Well, particular words aren't always used by biblical authors in exactly the same way, as you will know from the differences between Isaiah's Hebrew and Jeremiah's Hebrew. Or changing the scenario, you join a running club. And at the first training session, the coach says to you, right, the kind of breathing that you do when running at 5.5 minute mile pace, that's what I want to see you do now. And you see what's happening then in those two scenarios. That theology tutor is taking for granted that, number one, you read Hebrew, and that, number two, you've studied the book of Isaiah and the book of Jeremiah in Hebrew. And that running coach is taking it for granted that you can run at 5.5 minute mile pace. And in a funny kind of way, it has its own power, that, doesn't it? I mean, neither the tutor nor the coach is barking out demanding orders to you. Go and do this, go and do that. No, both of them are just calmly assuming. Calmly assuming certain things to be true of students who enroll on that course. Calmly assuming certain things to be true of runners who are at that club. And as I say, then, that quiet, unceremonious assuming has its own power. Listening to your tutor say that, or listening to your coach say that, it elicits from you a sharp intake of breath, doesn't it? Whoof, you think. This is some theology course. Whew, this is some running club. Now, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 8, Jesus is not commanding purity. That's a very basic point, and yet it's easily overlooked, and I'm going to expand on its significance later on, but I just want you to take note of it for now. Jesus is not commanding purity. In grammatical terms, you won't find any imperative in this verse, that is, any command, any order, anything telling you to do something. No, what Jesus is doing is he's assuming purity. Matthew 5 begins, doesn't it? When he sat down on the mountain, his disciples came to him. And Jesus then is addressing his disciples here. And throughout verses 2 to 11, these sayings that we know as the Beatitudes, throughout them all, he's calmly assuming certain things to be true of those who are his disciples. As I say, there isn't an imperative in sight here. And one of those things then that he assumes to be true of those who are his disciples is purity. He just takes it for granted that if you're a disciple of his, then purity matters to you. It's a big deal. It's something that you're profoundly committed to. And as we listen to our master calmly assuming that here, I want it to elicit from us a sharp intake of breath. Oof. I want us to think, this is some discipleship. Because it is. It is. I mean, that theology course in my illustration clearly is not for dabblers. That running club clearly is not for dabblers. And this discipleship clearly isn't for dabblers. To be a disciple of Jesus is to have entered upon a life of purity. Purity, of course, is not the qualification for entering into discipleship. It's not a prerequisite, as we often say. You come to Jesus and you become his disciple just as you are in all of your impurity. Purity is not a qualification for entering, but the thing you are entering is a life of purity. That is just what it is. Do you need reminding of that, perhaps? Do you need reminding that Christian discipleship is not a casual, laid-back affair? Rather, it's the kind of thing where your master can just drop in a formidable assumption like the one in Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. It is a life of purity. That's what Christian discipleship is. It is a life of purity. And as we reflect on that then, I want to highlight three things. And first of all, the arena. The arena. This purity that Jesus assumes will characterize his disciples, it's not just about external behavior. No, he refers, doesn't he, to the pure in heart. This purity prevails there, he says, in the arena of the heart, the arena, that is, of our thoughts and desires. In our Western democracies, we despise the concept of thought police, don't we? We insist that a person's private thoughts are quite simply none of the state's business. And that's absolutely right. But if you or I were to insist that our private thoughts are similarly none of Jesus' business, we would be wrong. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20, God willing, we'll come to it fairly soon in our Sunday evenings. You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. Jesus has purchased us. And I think it's fair to say that he paid a high enough price to secure the whole of us. Not just our bodies, the external dimension of us, but our hearts too, the internal dimension of our persons. It's his. He paid for it with his own blood, which means he's perfectly entitled to expect and assume purity there, in that deep-seated inner arena. And I'm sure you don't need me to tell you, it's an arena where impurity can easily reside. Impurity can reside in our hearts while outwardly we're compliant with Christian behavioral norms. So you can be outwardly civil in your relationships. But inwardly, you are disdaining a certain person or certain persons, wanting and rejoicing in their misfortune. That's not being pure in heart. Or you can be outwardly interested in others, congratulatory in respect of their achievements. But inwardly, you're utterly self-obsessed, feasting hungrily on every little compliment anyone pays you, your whole mood dictated by the esteem in which others hold you. That's not being pure in heart. Or you can be outwardly present at Christian church gatherings, singing the hymns, having your Bible open at the right page. But inwardly, you are barely pursuing a relationship with Christ at all anymore, because busyness and anxieties and discontentment with life have squeezed it out. That's not being pure in heart. Or you can be outwardly, and this I think is the example most pertinent to Matthew 5:8, you can be outwardly refraining from sinful sexual activity. But inwardly, you're immersed in sexual thoughts about a person or about persons to whom you aren't married. A person or persons who therefore is or are off limits to you. That's not being pure in heart. And my simple question at this point then is, how's your heart? How's your heart this evening? All I can do is ask the question, because I can't see into your hearts. None of the elders and none of your fellow church members can see into your heart. And perhaps that fact makes you breathe a sigh of relief and feel comfortable and safe, therefore, about your thought life. You shouldn't do. Because this is the thing, actually, if someone else in this room could see into your heart, that wouldn't really be of any consequence anyway. What is of consequence, however, is that your Lord Jesus can. He can see into it. I am he who searches mind and heart, he says in Revelation 2:23. The one who bought your heart with his own blood can see its every nook and its every cranny, and he's looking for purity there. He's looking for purity. Christian disciple, how's your heart? So that's the arena. Secondly, let's notice the avenue. The avenue. I think it's baked into our text that a key avenue by which impurity, and it's particularly, as I say, that last form of impurity I mentioned just now, sexual impurity, a key avenue by which sexual impurity takes residence in the heart is the eye. The eye, E-Y-E. Why do I say that? Well, as a primary reason and a secondary reason why I say it, the primary reason I'm not quite ready to disclose at this point in the sermon, but I can give you the secondary reason. Look at verse 28, such well-known words. And there in verse 28 of Matthew 5, Jesus returns, doesn't he, to the idea of this arena of the heart. It very much feels there like he's alluding back to our verse, to verse 8. And there then in verse 28, he's envisaging a situation in which sexual impurity has taken residence in the heart. He very bluntly refers to it, doesn't he, as adultery. But it isn't physical, it's entirely in the heart. And he makes it very clear how it's gotten there. Through looking, he says. Looking at someone with lustful intent. That has been the avenue. And just in case we've missed that point, he then goes on in the very next verse, verse 29, to speak of an eye causing you to sin. So I'm saying then, implicit in our verse, verse 8, is this idea of the eye as an avenue by which sexual impurity gets into the heart. And one of the reasons for saying that is this other verse close by in which explicitly the eye is an avenue for sexual immorality getting into the heart. Eyes are fantastic, precious organs, aren't they? That's why Becky is going tomorrow to have a cataract removed. Soon, indeed, I think there'll be more probably in our congregation who have had a cataract removed than those who haven't. And you have a cataract then, and you don't say to your GP, do you have, just take the eye out, I don't need it. No, you want your name to go on the waiting list, and you want the procedure to happen as soon as possible, because eyes are amazing. The way that they take in all the different colours. The way that they so accurately capture objective reality, so that when you're playing snooker with a friend, the same ball is the pink ball for your friend and for you. Eyes, they are fantastic, precious organs. But they're also dangerous. It's not just Matthew 5, is it, that teaches that? Go back to the Garden of Eden, and the eye begins to be dangerous there. And throughout the Bible, the eye is so dangerous for all its brilliance. Eyes are dangerous avenues by which sexual impurity takes residence in the heart. The eye makes contact with pornographical material, or it makes contact with inappropriate pictures friends are posting on social media, or it makes contact with immodestly dressed revelers on a nightclub dance floor. And it fastens on an object like that. And the object doesn't remain there within the eyeball. It passes from the eye into the heart and ignites all kinds of unclean thoughts. The eye is dangerous. That's why Jesus there in verse 29 talks about tearing out the eye. Of course, he doesn't mean drastically, painfully destroying the organ in your face. In the Bible, the body is too grand and dignified a thing to be treated like that. Pagans mutilate the body disciples of Jesus don't. But it does mean drastically, painfully destroying the possibility of the organ in your face being an avenue of sexual impurity, drastically, painfully making changes to your involvement in social media, perhaps. Maybe even making changes to what devices you actually possess in your home. Making changes to the kind of venues that you would ever patronize. Ensuring that your eye just cannot be that conduit, that channel, that avenue. Imagine that you have a back garden, and at the end of your back garden, there aren't other people's back gardens, rather there are fields or woods or there's some kind of wasteland out there. And there's a gate from your back garden to that land beyond it. And on a couple of occasions, an intruder comes in through the gate and vandalizes or steals from your property. That gate is a problem. It's a weak point, a point where your property is vulnerable. So you try to make it less so. You put about 6 different locks on the gate. You put signs on the outside of the gate warning intruders that a pack of savage Rottweilers patrols your property. Despite all that, however, one night there's another break-in via the gate. And so in the end, you decide there's only one thing for it. You must destroy the possibility of intruders accessing your property that way. You must brick up that point in your garden wall where the gate is. And it's a drastic and painful measure because you like using the gate yourself to get out into that countryside on the other side of it. But it's a no-brainer. It's worth that sacrifice in order to stop the intruders. Sadly, some of us perhaps would be far more concerned about keeping intruders out of our property than about keeping impurity out of our hearts. In that scenario I've just painted, well, it would be black and white for all of us, wouldn't it? Of course, the gate has to be bricked up, we would all say. But if it's a case of coming off social media, for example, suddenly it's very complicated. It's very tricky, you know. I'm not sure it's really feasible somehow. Disciple of Jesus Christ, your heart matters way more than your property does. Way more. If you're keen on protecting your property, be 10 times keener, be 100 times keener on protecting your heart. Do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes to destroy the possibility of your eyes being the access point for the wretched intruder that is sexual impurity. Do whatever it takes. You may not be addicted to shocking graphic imagery. You know what it's like over Christmas and New Year. And for a week or two, you eat an awful lot of junk. Far too many chocolates and mince pies and that kind of thing. And it isn't like consuming raw meat or toilet cleaner or something like that. It doesn't send your insides into terrible convulsions. It doesn't make you throw up. But it just increasingly makes you feel bloated and lethargic, doesn't it? So that you get to the point where you're convinced that you need a diet of celery and tap water throughout January to kind of detoxicate your insides. And perhaps then you frequently watch films and sitcoms on TV or scroll through posts online, and it's not really explicit content. It's not raw meat or toilet cleaner. It's just a drip, drip diet of low-level unwholesomeness. Brick up the gate, believer. Brick up the gate. I said this morning that holiness does involve activity and exertion. I said it doesn't begin there, and that is crucial. That is absolutely fundamental. It begins, as we saw, with a proper self-understanding. John Stott, the secret of holy living is in the mind. We must know who we are, that we are seated right now with Christ in the heavenly places. Get that into your heads. Holiness does not begin with activity and exertion. But once we have that right self-understanding, then it must involve activity and exertion. There's verses 1 to 4 of Colossians 3, isn't there? Get the self-understanding right, but then comes verse 5. Put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly. And a big part then of that activity and exertion, I'm saying, is bricking up the gates. Or tearing out the eyes, if you prefer Jesus' language. Drastically, painfully destroying the possibility of our eyes filling our hearts with impurity. Brick up the gate, believer. So we've seen the arena. We've seen the avenue. But then thirdly and finally, the assurance. The assurance. Now, I've been a little bit enigmatic at points this evening. I dropped in that point about Jesus assuming rather than commanding purity without really elaborating that. I intimated that Jesus has in mind here being pure in heart through dealing with your eyes without giving you the main reason for me saying that. So it's time now for me to lay my cards on the table, for me to come clean and to set out the logic undergirding our text. The logic actually behind all the Beatitudes. I think we miss the logic. I think we read the Beatitudes wrongly most of the time. We tend to regard the Beatitudes as working like this. The first half is a command, do this, and then the second half is the reward for keeping the command. That is not how the Beatitudes work. Just a few points on how they do work then. Number one, as we've already said, they're not commands, but assumptions. No imperatives. They're not commands, they're assumptions. Jesus' disciples are poor in spirit. They do practice meekness. They seek to de-escalate conflicts and bring peace to bear on those situations. And so we could go on. That is just what Jesus' disciples do and are. Number two, those attitudes and behaviors then, which characterize Jesus' disciples, according to these verses, they seem, on the face of things, profoundly disadvantageous. I mean, when did meekness ever get you anywhere? That's the attitude of our society, isn't it? When did meekness ever get anyone anywhere? Who wants to mourn? And as for peacemaking, I mean, that's usually a very painstaking and protracted business, isn't it? In which you're always taking one step forwards and then two steps back. Basically, practicing these attitudes and behaviors that we have in Matthew 5, 1 to 12, practice those and you're going to miss out. That's how it seems on the face of things. Which takes us to point number three. Jesus, however, in each case, assures his disciples they don't miss out. They don't miss out. Actually, they are blessed. Actually, they are in a fantastic situation. And that because of what lies ahead for his disciples in the age to come. The second half of these Beatitudes, I think in every case, mainly apply to the age to come. And Jesus is assuring his disciples then that what they will experience then infinitely outweighs and eclipses whatever apparent loss these attitudes and behaviors incur in the present. So that's how they all work, and that then is how this one works. Our text, verse 8. So, Jesus' disciples then, they practice heart purity. That's just the assumption Jesus is making. That's what they do. And in particular then, they do that through dealing with their eyes. They're dealing with looking and making sure that that avenue is bricked up. But you see, being so strict and scrupulous about the eyes, about what you see, seems on the face of things profoundly disadvantageous. I mean, if so many people watch pornography, if so many film directors feel obliged to include sex scenes in their movies, if so many people post inappropriate pictures on social media, then there must be something appealing about it all. And in rigorously, strenuously denying your eyes contact with any of it so that your heart isn't defiled, you're missing out on stuff which millions of our fellow human beings just can't get enough of. It seems, on the face of things, disadvantageous. However, Jesus assures us in the last part of the verse that that is not in fact the case. It doesn't matter how many sights we have to deny ourselves in order to keep our hearts pure. They are infinitely eclipsed and outweighed by a sight that awaits us. We don't miss out because there's a sight that is awaiting us, which is the very ultimate in visual possibility. We are going to see God. We are going to see God. And so to come back to what I said earlier, I had a primary reason and a secondary reason why I say sight is embedded in the first half of our text. I said the secondary reason is verse 28 later on. Well, the primary reason is that sight is there in the second half of our verse, isn't it? The assurance that we will see God in the second half of the verse must correspond to a not seeing that's implicit in the first half of the verse. Being pure in heart involves necessarily a not seeing of things that dirty our hearts, but don't worry about that not seeing, Jesus is saying, because you are going to see God. That's the logic. And what a thought then, believer. What a thought. There are sports stars who can do beautiful things on a tennis court or on a football pitch that you could watch enthralled over and over again, but who, appearing on Parkinson, not that that of course happens anymore, but on some show like that, you don't find very attractive persons at all. You don't think, oh, I'd love to spend a couple of hours having coffee with them. Their work is more beautiful than they themselves are. That's my point. And what you could say of sports stars, you could say of many artists and writers and musicians and architects and fashion designers. But imagine then if it were the other way around. Imagine a world in which beautiful sporting skills and beautiful artistic achievements were just a pale reflection of the actual persons behind them. So that the best tennis player would be as a person 10 times more captivating than even her elegant backhand slice. And the best musical composer would be as a person 10 times more captivating than even his signature concerto. Imagine that. Well, that is what it's like with God. I mean, we've all been captivated, haven't we, by the beauty of God's work. A sky full of stars on a clear, dark night. A jagged, snow-capped mountain range. A thundering waterfall plunging down a cliff and pounding the pool below. We've all been captivated by the beauty of God's work. But you know, as a being, God isn't 10 times, but 1,000,000 times, 1,000,000,000,000 times more captivating than any of his work is. As a person, as a being, God is 1,000,000 times more captivating than his starlit skies are. As a being, he's 1,000,000 times more captivating than his mountain ranges are. 1,000,000 times more captivating than his cascading waterfalls are. They just faintly reflect in the palest way his beauty. And we are going to see him. We see his skies, his waterfalls, his mountain ranges now. One day we're going to see the infinite beauty behind those little beauties. What a thought that is. Our eyes are going to feast on the glory of the triune God. We're going to gaze on the Father and gaze and gaze and gaze and gaze on the Son and gaze and gaze and then gaze on the Spirit and gaze and gaze. Surely, with that prospect ahead of you, believer, you can do a bit more tearing out of your right eye this week. You can do a bit more bricking up the gate this week. By itself, it may seem an unattractive and a difficult and even an impossible activity. But with that prospect before you, the sight of God, you can cope with not seeing things. You can cope with dealing with your eyes. You're going to see God in a world of filth, believer. In a world of filth and dirt and grime. Practice purity of heart. Deny yourself sights that others would say you're missing out by denying yourself those. Deny yourself them. Because a sight awaits you that defies all description, all comprehension. The most glorious of all sights, God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Amen.